Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today we're reading from the December 6, 2024 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week shows a martial arts fighting match between Vladimir Putin and Volodymyr Zelensky. They're both wearing the white sort of martial arts garb. But Putin has just flipped Zelensky over his leg and looks like he's about to pin him on the floor. In the background, you can sort of vaguely see some people cheering on the fight. One of them's definitely Donald Trump, and looks like some of his cronies back there cheering on Putin. The headline is, "Losing ground with Russia's advance accelerating, is there still hope for Ukraine?" That is one of our main stories, but we will start with the first one. I think we'll read both main stories today. First up, Trump fills out cabinet with loyalists and billionaires. What happened? President-elect Donald Trump completed his top cabinet nominations this week with a flurry of picks issued at record speed that veered from highly qualified institutionalists to outsider MAGA loyalists. None carried the shock value of early selections such as former Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz, who last week took himself out of the contention for attorney general. The GOP bomb thrower had faced scrutiny in the Senate over accusations of illegal drug use and the sex trafficking of an underage girl, allegations Gaetz denies. Within hours of Gaetz's exit, Trump announced a new nominee for the post, former Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi. A defense lawyer in his first impeachment trial and chair of a Trump-aligned think tank, Bondi has called special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Trump's Russia ties worse than Watergate and falsely alleged cheating by Democrats in the 2020 election. The president-elect nominated Russell Vaught, a co-author of the arch-conservative Project 2025 policy blueprint that Trump repeatedly disavowed on the campaign trail, to lead the Office of Management and Budget. That would put Vaught in charge of overseeing Trump's budget and enacting his policies across federal agencies. Vaught, who helmed OMB during Trump's first term, has assailed the woke and weaponized bureaucracy and advocates tight presidential control over agencies. Trump held Vaught as an aggressive cost cutter and deregulator who knows exactly how to dismantle the deep state. Trump blasted out nine other high-ranking picks in a Friday night flurry of social media posts. For Treasury, he tapped Scott Bessent, a billionaire hedge fund manager whom many business leaders welcomed as a sober pragmatist. He selected Dr. Jeanette Neshawat, a Fox News contributor who's written a book about the healing power of prayer, as Surgeon General. To oversee the FDA, he picked Martin Makary, a surgeon who opposed COVID vaccine mandates. For CDC head, he chose former Florida Representative Dave Weldon, who has championed the debunked claim that childhood vaccines cause autism. What the editorial said: Bondi is an experienced prosecutor who lacks Gaetz's lurid baggage, said the South Florida's Sun Sentinel. But she's still a hardcore Trump loyalist whose tenure as state attorney general was a mishmash of mediocrity and right-wing politics. She squashed a probe into scandal-plagued Trump University after getting a $25,000 campaign donation from a Trump family foundation. At the 2016 Republican convention, she deemed her office by leading a lock her up chant against Hillary Clinton. Demeaned her office, excuse me, by leading a lock her up chant against Hillary Clinton. And after Trump's 2020 defeat, she parroted his false claims of voter fraud. Such rabid partisanship has no place in the Justice Department. Trump's pick for Labor Secretary is a surprise, said the Wall Street Journal, and a regrettable one. He tapped Representative Lori Chavez DeRemer, Republican from Oregon, a pro-union first-termer backed by Teamsters President Sean O'Brien. She supported misguided measures that would override right-to-work laws in 26 states and require all states and localities to collectively bargain with government workers, a recipe for turning GOP-led states into fiscal basket cases like California. Instead of empowering union bosses, Trump should reward blue-collar supporters with policies that spur economic growth and a robust job market. What the columnist said. Trump's labor choice underlines the grab bag nature of his cabinet, said Bill Barrow in the Associated Press. They're an eclectic bunch, raising questions about what ideological anchors might guide his term. Chavez DeRemer will serve alongside multiple billionaires who oppose unions. Deficit hawk Bessent will serve a president who has promised tax cuts without entitlement rollbacks, while Secretary of State nominee Senator Marco Rubio, who's pilloried authoritarian regimes around the world, will be top diplomat for a president who praises autocratic leaders. With Trump's health agency picks, his vision for a sweeping overhaul is coming into focus, said Emily Anthus and Emily Baumgartner in the New York Times. They have varying qualifications and public health views, but they have all pushed back against COVID policies or supported ideas that are outside the medical mainstream, including an opposition to vaccines. It's a terrifying omen for many doctors and scientists who are bracing themselves for the gutting of public health agencies and the injection of politics into realms once reserved for academics. Bot's return to OMB is deeply troubling, said Hayes Brown in MSNBC.com. He's been a radical voice in the ear of MAGA Republicans in Congress, urging their most destructive tendencies. He's called for cutting $2 trillion from Medicaid, $400 billion from food stamps, and gutting the Affordable Care Act. Bot aims to wipe out swaths of federal administrators with deep experience, said Alice Herman in The Guardian. And the self-declared Christian nationalist has espoused authoritarian ideas such as using the military to crack down on protest. Bondi beats Gates, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer, but it's a swap no one should be celebrating. She'll still be the most dangerous attorney general in history, aiding and abetting Trump's authoritarian vision. It's a reminder that whatever stumbles he might make, Trump will end up with a MAGA government that will reject vaccine science, torpedo the fight against climate change, and cut taxes for billionaires while gutting social services. America has survived the likes of John Mitchell and Bill Barr atop the Justice Department, but now stares into a much darker abyss. And our second main story, Russia gains ground as U.S. rushes aid to Ukraine. What happened? Russian forces advanced in Ukraine this week at the fastest pace yet in the war, taking 90 square miles of territory, battering Kyiv with drones, and hitting central Dnipro with an experimental ballistic missile. In a bellicose speech, Russian President Vladimir Putin called the use of the hypersonic Oreshnik missile, which is designed to carry a nuclear payload, a response to NATO's aggressive actions against Russia, meaning the Biden administration's recent decision to allow Ukraine to to fire U.S.-made ATACMS missiles into Russia. Putin threatened that nuclear attacks on NATO countries could follow. The war, he said, had assumed elements of a global nature, and Russia was entitled to strike countries that allow their weapons to be used against our facilities. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called the Oreshnik strike an escalation and said Ukraine would ask its allies for advanced air defense systems. With just months to go before President-elect Donald Trump takes office, the Biden administration has been fast-tracking $275 million in new weaponry to Ukraine, including more HIMARS rocket launchers and, for the first time, anti-personnel mines. But the assistance comes as Ukraine is losing ground and struggling with low morale. Ukrainian military sources said this week that Russia had retaken 40% of the territory that Ukraine had captured in Russia's Kursk region this summer. And in a poll released last week, more than half of Ukrainians supported negotiations to end the war as soon as possible, up from just a quarter last year. "People are tired," Vavashlav Komeko, a platoon commander based in Kursk. "At least once a month, I have to remind them that they're fighting so their grandkids won't have to," what the editorial said. "The slow walking of U.S. aid has been a frustrating exercise," said the Dallas Morning News. Fearing the potential Russian response, the Biden administration has repeatedly withheld advanced weapon systems, such as M1 Abrams tanks and F-16 fighter jets, before relenting too late, after Russia had already made significant gains. Once again, the White House has finally granted the request to strike inside Russia with ATACMS, and France and the UK have followed with their own permissions. But why now, after the possibility of slowing Russian resupply is off the table? "Perhaps because the January inauguration will change everything," said the Washington Post. With Trump having pledged to strike a quick deal to end the conflict, Russia and Ukraine are both racing to put themselves in the best possible position for the coming peace talks. Russia wants to control all of Ukraine's Donbas region, while Ukraine simply wants to survive with its sovereignty and as much of its pre-invasion territory as possible. Escalating now is a risk, sure, but a truce that leaves Ukraine untenable, territorially diminished, is a worse one, what the columnist said. "This is an odd position for a superpower to be in," said Andrew Sullivan in his Substack newsletter. "Simultaneously ramping up aggression against Russia to a new nuclear-tinged level while signaling it will soon try to end the war anyway." Putin's speech was bizarre. The video looked like AI, with his head moving but his hands eerily immobile, but his anger seemed real. One of the long-range strikes Biden greenlit for Ukraine, an attack with British Storm Shadow missiles, apparently killed Russian officers on Russian soil. That's a whole new category of conflict that Biden has recklessly ignited. "Let's keep some perspective," said Mark Champion in Bloomberg. "We are not on the cusp of a nuclear conflagration. Even though Putin recently lowered his threshold to use a nuclear bomb, there are still immense hurdles and costs involved in actually launching one. Still, Russia is escalating the war in very concrete ways, scaling up bombardment and recruiting North Koreans and even Yemenis to press the manpower advantage." Essentially, Putin has already won, said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch. Ukraine's most powerful ally, the U.S., will soon be led by an administration that's neutral at best and pro-Russia at worst. And it's that change, not any red line crossed, that makes nuclear war more likely. The prospect of the isolationist Trump entering the White House spells the end of deterrence. Nuclear-armed dictators will menace their neighbors, who will then seek to gain nukes themselves. Whether or not it happens in Ukraine, nuclear conflict will be more likely in a world no longer secured by the Pax Americana. Controversy of the week. Senate Republicans, a check on Trump's power. The first step of defiance is the hardest, said William Kristol in The Bulwark. And Senate Republicans just took it by rejecting Donald Trump's initial pick for Attorney General, Matt Gaetz. The scandal hit former Florida congressman announced last week that he was withdrawing from consideration for the role, saying that he didn't want to be a distraction for the president-elect. The truth is that Gaetz, faced with detailed accusations that he had used illegal drugs, paid women for sex, and had sex with an underage girl, lacked the votes to be confirmed. At least four Republican senators in the next Congress were hard-nosed. Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Susan Collins of Maine, Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, and John Curtis of Utah, enough to sink him in a 53-seat majority. So much for Trump's dream that the Senate would be his rubber stamp, said David Rothkopf in the Daily Beast. In the aftermath of Election Day, Donald Trump stood astride American politics like a colossus, demanding that the incoming Senate majority abandon its constitutional responsibility to vet and approve his nominees. But with this quiet act of backroom resistance, Senate Republicans have shown that his power is not limitless. Hold the celebration, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. Gaetz was a uniquely awful pick for Attorney General, and there are reports Trump chose him as a sacrificial lamb to make his other picks look sober and qualified. Whether or not that's true, Senate Republicans might use Gaetz as an excuse to give other Trump nominees a free pass. Voting for the conspiracy theorist Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to oversee public health, for example, could spare those senators from an Elon Musk-funded primary opponent and or death threats from the MAGA faithful. Trump's MO is to relentlessly pressure test people and institutions until they surrender, said Michelle Cottle in the New York Times. The senators who blocked Gaetz deserve a hat tip, but this is just the beginning of Trump's efforts to bring the upper chamber to heel. Trump's a paper tiger, said Andrew Egger in The Bulwark. Yes, he can snap his fingers and summon primary challengers for any who displease him. But that threat means nothing to someone like McConnell, 82, who is probably serving his final term, or to moderates like Collins, whose seats are in danger if they don't show independence. The true test will be Tulsi Gabbard, said Chris Steierwalt in the Dispatch. Trump's pick to oversee national intelligence is an apologist for the gruesome regimes of Russia's Vladimir Putin and Syria's Bashar al-Assad, and a fan of NSA leaker-turned-Russian citizen Edward Snowden. The Senate Intelligence Committee, one of the chamber's last bastions of functionality and bipartisanship, will surely kill her nomination the first chance it gets. No disrespect to Gabbard or Trump's other aberrant picks, said Jonathan Chait in The Atlantic, but Pete Hegseth is far more dangerous than any of them. The Fox News host that Trump wants to make defense secretary considers himself to be at war with basically everybody to Trump's left. His five books reveal, and has contemplated the use of military force to save America from liberalism. Senators must vet Trump's nominees carefully, said Ramesh Panuru in the Washington Post. During his first term, the officials who restrained his worst impulses did him a favor, preventing scandals and disasters that could have derailed his presidency. Senators owe it to Trump and the rest of us to do him that favor again. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for study aides. After Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Donald Trump picked to be Secretary of Health and Human Services, told a podcaster that he did very, very poorly in school until I started doing narcotics. After discovering heroin, explained Kennedy, suddenly I could sit still and I could read and I could concentrate. It was a good week for second acts. After former Representative Matt Gaetz, who last week withdrew from consideration to be Trump's attorney general amid sexual misconduct allegations, set up shop on the Cameo social platform, selling pep talks and personalized greetings for only $550 per 90-second video. It was a good week for Italian food. After British nano-engineers created the world's skinniest spaghetti. Each strand is 372 nanometers wide, thinner than some wavelengths of light. I don't think it's useful as pasta, sadly, said researcher Gareth Williams, as it would overcook in less than a second. But it was also a bad week for Italian food. After Pizza Hut China debuted a limited edition thick crust pie topped with a deep fried bullfrog. Sold as Goblin Pizza, the pie also features halved hard boiled eggs and black olives that serve as stand ins for the dead frog's eyes. It was a bad week for binge eating after a South Korean man was convicted of trying to avoid mandatory military service by piling on pounds. The man, 26, doubled his daily food intake before his physical exam for the draft and was classified as obese, allowing him to serve in a non-combat role at a government agency. He received a one-year suspended sentence. Finally, it was a bad week for special deliveries. After crew aboard the International Space Station complained that an unnamed Russian spacecraft transporting supplies emitted an unexpected odor as soon as they opened the airlock. There are no concerns for the crew, said NASA in a statement. Here's a short and other news piece. Biden proposes expanded coverage for anti-obesity meds. The Biden administration announced plans this week to have popular weight loss drugs such as Ozempic and Wegovy covered by Medicare and Medicaid, a proposal Health and Human Services Secretary Xavier Becerra called a game changer in the fight against obesity. The plan, which would apply only to people who are obese, would expand coverage of the medications to 7.5 million Americans and cost the federal government $36 billion over the next decade. But health advocates say the change could save the government billions on treatments for obesity-related conditions. The proposal sets up a fight with the incoming Donald Trump administration, which must finalize the plan. Trump's pick to lead Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., argues that weight loss drugs mask the root causes of America's health problems, too much junk food and too little exercise. And the briefing, the hillbilly VP. In under a decade, J.D. Vance went from never Trumper to Trump's vice president-elect. What changed? How did Vance's political rise begin? It started with the 2016 publication of his memoir, Hillbilly Elegy. In the bestseller, J.D. Vance, then working in San Francisco as a venture capitalist, describes his tumultuous upbringing in a poor family in Rust Belt, Ohio, and diagnoses the woes of Greater Appalachia. From low social mobility to poverty to divorce and drug addiction, he wrote, "My home is a hub of misery." For liberal commentators struggling to understand why so many white working class voters backed Donald Trump in the 2016 election, the book was an eye-opener. At the time, Vance was a staunch Trump opponent. In public, he called the Republican cultural heroine. In private, he likened Trump to Adolf Hitler. But Vance's views began to shift after Trump's first election win. He adopted Trump's talking points in his successful 2022 run for an Ohio Senate seat, embracing the border wall, hostility to Ukraine, and Ukraine aid, and the false claim that the 2020 election was stolen, and served as a MAGA attack dog after being picked as Trump's running mate. Now, as vice president-elect, he's a heartbeat away from the Oval Office. If you think about where he came from and where he is at 40 years old, said conservative analyst Yuval Levin, J.D. is the single most successful member of his generation in American politics. What was his early life like? Deeply chaotic. He was born in the ailing industrial city of Middletown, Ohio, to a family from the hills of eastern Kentucky. His parents divorced when he was a toddler, and his drug-addicted mother struggled to care for him. Hillbilly Elegy describes how she hit him, once threatened to kill him in a car crash, and used his urine to pass drug tests. Vance was largely raised by his grandmother and grandfather, who had a violent and dysfunctional relationship. Still, Vance has spoken admiringly of how Mama and Papa stayed together and provided stability in his life. The post-sexual revolution idea that people should be able to divorce and shift spouses like they change their underwear, Vance said in 2021, doesn't work out for the kids of those marriages. After high school, he enlisted in the Marines and in 2005 was deployed to Iraq, where he worked in public affairs. He later wrote that he went overseas as a young idealist committed to spreading democracy and liberalism to the backward nations of the world, and returned in 2006, skeptical of the war and the ideology that underpinned it. Back in the U.S., he attended Ohio State and then Yale Law School. How did college shape him? At Yale, where 95% of his fellow students hailed from the upper middle class, Vance said he initially felt like an outsider and was looked down on by at least one professor. "I have never felt out of place," he wrote, "but I did at Yale." His peers recall Vance as an outgoing, intellectually curious student. He met his future wife, Usha Chilakuri, the daughter of an Indian immigrant, in his first year. After Yale, Usha clerked for the future Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh and for Chief Justice John Roberts. Vance worked as a corporate lawyer before joining a venture capital firm run by tech investor Peter Thiel, a donor to hard-right Republicans who would later put $15 million into Vance's Senate campaign. Vance had attended a 2011 Yale talk by Thiel in which the gay Christian billionaire spoke about the decay of Western society. "Thiel was possibly the smartest person I'd ever met," Vance wrote later. "He defied the social template I had constructed, that dumb people were Christians and smart ones atheists." In 2019, Vance, then back in Ohio, building his political base, converted to Catholicism. Why did he become a Trump supporter? To some critics, it was a cynical ploy to succeed in the MAGA-dominated GOP. What you see is some really profound opportunism, said David Niven, who teaches politics at the University of Cincinnati. A friend of Vance told the New Yorker that after Trump's 2016 win, Vance worried how the new president's allies would take his past criticisms. He said, "The Trump people want me out." Vance has said there was no eureka moment when he changed his views. Instead, he came to realize that he'd focused on the stylistic element of Trump and missed how the former president shared his beliefs, that free trade has hurt American communities, and that the nation's leaders were too quick to jump into foreign wars. Did Vance change after embracing Trumpism? He started to adopt Trump's combative style during his 2022 Senate run, railing against Democratic elites who have spent their lives playing a status game and who didn't have children. Vance has three. "We are effectively run in this country," Vance said, "by a bunch of childless cat ladies." He secured World's endorsement after a Republican debate in which he was the only candidate to oppose a no-fly zone in Ukraine. The following day, Donald Trump Jr. tweeted, "JD is 100% America first." What did he do as a senator? He pushed MAGA politics on restricting immigration and opposing gun restrictions, but also worked with Democratic colleagues on tougher banking regulations and railroad safety measures. He initially supported a national abortion ban, saying it might be necessary to stop women traveling to other states for terminations, but now says he backs Trump's state-by-state approach. It's not yet clear what issues Vance will focus on as vice president, but it's expected that he will try to build his brand as Trump's heir apparent ahead of a possible 2028 presidential run. "We are getting four more years of Trump," Trump Jr. said just days before the November 5th election, "and then 8 years of J.D. Vance." And we'll read a few of the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S. "Voters resent the elites, not the rich." Many Democrats are blaming their crushing loss to Donald Trump on the party's failure to appeal to working-class voters, said Noah Smith. Senator Bernie Sanders said the party must embrace economic justice if it's to win elections again. But class politics is unlikely to succeed where identity politics failed, for the simple reason that Americans simply lack a clear idea of who the working class actually is. In our country, cultural and social issues often take precedence over pocketbook concerns. The real class distinction today is educational level. Many Americans who identify as working class feel alienated from the progressive culture and attitudes of highly educated urban professionals, people who use terms like cisgender, heteronormative, and cultural appropriation. President Biden actually did a huge amount of pro-worker policy with strong support of unions and billions in stimulus targeted at the lowest income workers. The result? Lower earning voters still abandoned Kamala Harris en masse. Less educated people saw her as part of the coastal elite they don't trust. Trump won because working class voters do not really resent the rich. They resent people who've left them behind economically and culturally. The GOP's foolish attack on Medicaid. Republicans have revived their cruelest health care reform, said Michael Hiltzik. They want to impose work requirements on Medicaid. Contrary to GOP myth, nearly two-thirds of Medicaid users work full or part-time, and nearly all the rest are taking care of children or aging parents, are chronically ill or disabled, or are students or retired. Work requirements only serve to throw eligible people out of Medicaid. These people get booted mostly through administrative snafus after they fail to prove they're working or are exempt. When Arkansas implemented work requirements in 2018, 17,000 people lost eligibility, and a federal judge declared the requirement illegal. Conservatives hold a historic disdain for Medicaid, viewing it as welfare for the undeserving poor, not as health care insurance. This makes it politically easier to cut benefits. Republicans are hunting for cuts to defray the $4 trillion cost of extending their 2017 tax cuts. But Medicaid work requirements would only save $10 billion annually, a tiny dent in the $853 billion spent on Medicaid's 72 million recipients last year. In a rational world, this idea would have been consigned to the dumpster long ago. This column comes from Canada. How America's madness will infect us. Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s quackery will make people sick on both sides of the border, said Rawat Dhanandan. Incoming U.S. President Donald Trump's pick for Health and Human Services Secretary is an anti-vaccine zealot who insists that Wi-Fi radiation causes autism and that AIDS results not from HIV, but the gay lifestyle. His anti-vax lies fueled a 2019 measles outbreak in Samoa that killed 83 people, most of them children. If confirmed to the cabinet, the ivermectin-popping RFK Jr. will likely demand dramatic changes in funded research priorities and slowdowns to vaccine licensing. And that will hurt Canada, because our Institutes of Health Research moves in lockstep with the U.S. National Institutes of Health. But RFK Jr.'s biggest impact will be cultural. He will normalize anti-evidence pseudoscience, homeopathy, urine therapy, energy healing, and fuel opposition here in Canada to safe and proven public health measures. And because viruses jump borders, if he hinders vaccine access in the next pandemic, Canadians will get sick. The bright side? Maybe this will be the moment Canada breaks from American health leadership, as we should have done during COVID, and boosts domestic vaccine and therapeutic manufacturing. Perhaps we might even attract some of the world's top medical minds as they flee the churn of misinformation south of the border. And the last word, our feature article, History's Greatest Puzzle. The Voynich Manuscript is one of the most alluring and intractable mysteries of the medieval world, said Ariel Sabar in The Atlantic. It may be starting to give up its secrets. Lisa Fagan Davis was starting her medieval studies PhD at Yale in 1989 when she got a part-time job at the university's Beinecke Rare Book and Manuscript Library. Her boss was the curator of early books and manuscripts, and he stuck her with an unenviable duty, answering letters from cranks, conspiracists, and truthers who hounded the library with questions about its most popular holding. In the library catalog, the book, a parchment codex the size of a hardcover novel, had a simple, colorless title, Cipher Manuscript. But newspapers tended to call it the Voynich Manuscript, after the rare books dealer Wilfred Voynich, who acquired it around 1912 from a Jesuit collection in Italy. An heir sold the manuscript to another dealer, who donated it to Yale in 1969. Davis grew up in Oklahoma City, transfixed by the fantasy worlds of J.R.R. Tolkien and Dungeons and Dragons. When the Beinecke curator first showed her the Voynich manuscript, she thought, "This is the coolest thing I've ever seen." Its 234 pages contained some 38,000 words, but not one of them was readable. The book's unnamed author had written it, likely with a quill pen, in symbols never before seen. Did they represent a natural language such as Latin, a constructed language like Esperanto, a secret code, gibberish? Scholars had no real idea. To Davis, however, the manuscript felt alive with meaning. Flowering through the indecipherable script were otherworldly illustrations, strange prehistoric-looking plants with leaves and dreamy geometries, oversized pages that folded out to reveal Rosetta's, zodiacs, stars, the cosmos, lists of apparent medicinal formulas alongside drawings of herbs and spindly bottles. Most striking of all were the groups of naked women. They held stars on strings like balloons, or stood in green pools fed by trickling ducks and by pipes that looked like fallopian tubes. Many of the women, arms outstretched, seemed less to be bathing than working, as plumbers in some primordial waterworks. Although the book's parchment and pigments looked medieval, the drawings of the women had no close cultural parallel in any era. Even the plants, which appeared to have the stems of one species and the roots of another, resisted identification. Davis, then 23 years old, with a rosy sense of the world's knowability, wanted to figure out what the Voynich manuscript was, what it meant, where it came from. But people in her field saw the Voynich as a waste of time, a house of curiosities gewgaw, unworthy of the serious scholar, especially when so many legible manuscripts begged for study. In any case, scholars had already tried. The manuscript had reeled them in with what one cryptanalyst called a surface appearance of simplicity, letters that looked glancingly Latin, words that repeated with language-like regularity, handwriting that had the easy flow of a long-established script. But so many headline-making solutions had been debunked over the years that the text had earned a reputation, in the words of Beinecke librarian, as the place where academic careers go to die. I met Davis in Boston this past March, some 35 years after her youthful infatuation with the manuscript. She had risen to one of her discipline's most visible posts, executive director of the Medieval Academy of America, the premier professional organization for North American medievalists, which she has led for more than a decade. The Voynich manuscript had re-entered Davis' life, forcing her to reconsider almost everything she thought she knew about it. Back in 2016, she opened an email from Yale University Press that asked if she would peer review the essays in a forthcoming facsimile edition of the Voynich manuscript, a coffee table book that featured high-resolution, life-size images of every one of its pages. The Beinecke's then-director, Edwin C. Schroeder, had grown frustrated by the constant questions his staff got about the Voynich. The Beinecke, a marble-paned building somewhere between modernist cathedral and spaceship, held more than 1 million genuinely meaningful texts, among them a Shakespeare first folio, a Gutenberg Bible, the papers of Edith Wharton, and a 3rd-century fragment of a Pauline epistle, but sometimes it felt as if the only text that visitors cared about was the one nobody could read. And too often, the way they cared about it was to proclaim that they'd solved it. A New Jersey doctor argued that the Voynich was a manual in Flemish Creole of death rites for an ancient cult of Isis. A Texas chemist spied what she took to be the signature of Leonardo da Vinci. When Beinecke officials permitted one self-proclaimed scholar to examine the Voynich, only to see a social media post afterward about her conducting some sort of seance, it was like, "All right," Schroeder recalled, "we need to change some of the conversation." The volume's editor was the Beinecke's new early books and manuscripts curator, a historian named Raymond Clemens. Times had changed. One essay told of how Wilfred Voynich remade himself from a Polish revolutionary into a charming New York antiquarian. Another documented the Voynich's suspected provenance, with evidence suggesting that the manuscript had been owned by the 16th century Holy Roman Emperor Rudolf II before passing through the hands of a court pharmacist, a Prague alchemist, a Bohemian doctor, and a German polymath on its way to the Jesuits in Italy. Davis' response to the Yale University Press email was a rave. The Voynich literature contained so much unscientific and unsupported rubbish that people couldn't tell fact from fiction, she wrote. A book of sound research was long overdue. But if the Beinecke's leaders thought it would change the conversation or slow the influx of questions, they had miscalculated. The ranks of enthusiasts, Voynicheros, as they're sometimes called, appeared only to grow. In 2017, the Times Literary Supplement ran a cover story titled simply, "Voynich Manuscript, The Solution," arguing that the manuscript was a health manual for the more well-to-do women in society. Around the same time, a Canadian civil engineer concluded that the Voynich was a Tibetan Bible, while a Russian electrical engineer glimpsed an algorithm for conducting a ritual that protected women from sexual violence by vampires. A biological scientist at the University of Bristol claimed he'd identified the language of the Voynich as proto-romance. "Sorry, folks," Davis tweeted. "Proto-romance language is not a thing. This is just more aspirational, circular, self-fulfilling nonsense." A YouTube channel produced a video of failed Voynich solutions that identified her as executive director of the Medieval Academy of America and reigning queen of academic burns. But Davis developed second thoughts about her social media smackdowns. If she wanted to dignify the manuscript as worthy of serious scholarship, she realized she would need to be more than just a critic. Late in the summer of 2018, an announcement went out about the following year's International Congress on Medieval Studies. Organizers were soliciting papers for a panel on ciphers, scripts, and shorthands. Davis knew well the Voynich's reputation as a career killer. But she'd reached a point in her own career where she felt she could take the risk. Neither a linguist nor a cryptanalyst, she would make no attempt to decode it, she decided. She would instead confine her study to her deepest specializations. Davis is an elected member of the Comité International de Paléographie Latine, a prestigious guild of the world's top paleographers and codicologist, experts in, by turns, ancient handwriting and the physical properties of old books. Of the Paris-based Society's 67 members, Davis is one of only 4 to be admitted from the United States. Did one person create the Voynich? At first glance, it seemed so. But as Davis magnified the handwriting, she noticed subtle variations. In certain places, the script was more cramped or more likely to slant as it crossed the page. She tested this observation by picking a letter that didn't appear often and tracking it across the manuscript's pages. Its style, she saw, varied among the groups of pages, but not within those groups. After months of analysis, she concluded that even if the Voynich had a single guiding vision, it was the handiwork of five different scribes. The book's physical condition filled in more of the picture. Even before anyone wrote on it, the calfskin parchment had holes where scabs, wounds, or insects had stricken the animal it had come from. One of several signs that the manuscript's makers couldn't afford or didn't need the finest materials. The pigments were ordinary, and the luxuries, such as gold leaf, were wholly absent. Like a manual of anatomy or an almanac of the stars, it was meant to be flipped through and used. If five scribes had come together to write it, the manuscript was probably the work of a community, rather than of a single deranged mind or con artist. Davis' work brought like-minded scholars out of hiding. In just the past few years, a Yale linguist named Claire Bowern had begun performing sophisticated analyses of the text, building on the efforts of earlier scholars and on methods Bowern had used with undocumented indigenous languages in Australia. At the University of Malta, computer scientists were figuring out how to analyze Voynich with tools for natural language processing. Researchers found that the manuscript's roughly 38,000 words and 9,000 word vocabulary had many of the statistical hallmarks of actual language. The Voynich's most common word, whatever it meant, appeared roughly twice as often as the second most common word and three times as often as the third commonest, and so on, a touchstone of natural language known as Zipf's Law. In late 2022, the Voynich Research Group, as it became known, held its first conference with 16 peer-reviewed papers touching on history, literature, paleology, linguistics, cryptology, and, because of some of the drawings, medieval gynecology. Davis was invited to give the closing keynote. Scholars inside and outside the group are now pressing in a variety of directions. Some are using mathematical tools to hunt for cribs, words whose meanings can be inferred because they consistently appear, like labels, beside certain illustrated objects. Others are reevaluating the alphabets that earlier scholars created to convert Voynichese letter forms into machine-readable ASCII text, the raw data for computational studies of the language. AI might be unable to decrypt the Voynich, but it could contribute in other ways. Once enough of the world's hundreds of thousands of medieval manuscripts are digitally imaged and accessible, models trained on those images may eventually develop the power to spot visual similarities to the Voynich. The curvature of a particular pen stroke, the shades of certain pigments that have eluded the human eye. But what if the Voynich remains unsolvable? What if the manuscript is some sense smarter than us all? Its anonymous author or authors laughing from the grave at the hubris of reason. When I posed these questions to one of Bowern's graduate students, she recited a Robert Frost poem. We dance round in a ring and suppose, but the secret sits in the middle and knows. On a sunny day this past April, I walked into the Beinecke with Davis and Bowern and descended the steps to a basement classroom where a librarian had set the Voynich on a pillow that keeps stresses off the book's old body. Bowern teaches an undergraduate Yale linguistics class on the Voynich, and today was her students' one chance to see it in the flesh. Hands clasped behind their back, many of them leaned gingerly towards its open pages as if in the presence of something sublime. Davis, too, still feels the tug of the manuscript's ineffable magic, But today she had come from Boston to ground Bowron students in its hard physical facts. The blotches where some ancient reader may have spilled her water jug. The ellipses of pinpricks where someone with needle and thread had tried long ago, and without success, to mend one of the parchment's many holds. A year earlier, while lecturing at a different college, Davis had fielded a question about what made the Voynich so sensational. Was it that some band of medieval women might have come together to preserve their secrets? Was it the text's spirituality, or the possibility that it said something about the Holy Grail, or living water? Davis gently steered her questioner away from speculation. The Voynich is not imaginary, Davis said. It's an actual object. It exists in space and time. It has a history. It has physical characteristics. And because of that, it has a true story. We just don't know what that true story is yet. A longer version of this story originally appeared in the Atlantic. And just enough time for a couple of quotes. There's a funny one from former Surgeon General Jocelyn Elders, who says, collaboration is an unnatural act between non-consenting adults. And Samuel Pepys gives some good advice. He says, be most slow to believe what we most wish should be true. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call. It's 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.